I am Daniel LaBouche.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is created to empower music itself, and legendary icon in the music industry. How heaven hit the charts, the ruckus revolution of religion in music, part two.
Yes, indeed. So as we've seen in part one, the 1960s were loud. Protests filled the streets and rock bands filled farmland and racetracks, and culture was changing faster than anyone could keep up. But in the middle of all that noise, something unexpected kept happening. Songs about faith were climbing the charts, not hidden away in church halls, not confined to gospel radio. These were religious songs that crossed over, becoming global hits sung by believers and non-believers alike. From the spiritual yearnings of the 1950s to the countercultural awakening of the 1970s, popular music became an unlikely vessel for the search for transcendence. In conclusion, this is the story of how heaven found its way onto the charts.
Indeed, the charts. And we talk about rock bands exploring spirituality, but there's one phenomenon we have not touch yet, Jesus Christ Superstar. This one is just a song. It was a cultural earthquake. What made it controversial and why did it resonate so deeply, Mr. Mac?
Well, Jesus Christ Superstar is one of the most important intersections of religion and popular music in the 20th century. It started as a concept album in 1970, composed by Andrew Lloyd Webber with lyrics by Tim Rice, and it told the story of the last week of Jesus' life, but from a radically humanized perspective. The album was a rock opera, Think Tommy by The Who, but with the Gospels as source material. The music was loud, theatrical, and modern. Ian Gillan from Deep Purple sang the role of Jesus. The orchestration included electric guitars, rock drums, and operatic vocals. This wasn't church music. This was arena rock about the passion of Christ. And it was controversial from the moment it was released, but not exclusively. Perhaps the most significant positive reference comes from the highest level of the Catholic Church. Pope Paul VI, after a private screening of the 1973 film, he reportedly told director Norman Jewison, "I believe this show will bring more people around the world to Christianity than anything else has before." He particularly praised Mary Magdalene's "I Don't Know How to Love Him" for its inspired beauty. The Vatican in 1999 officially endorsed the film during the 2000 Jubilee year, recognizing its potential for evangelization. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops eventually rated the film as a sincere, if naive, effort to tell the story of Jesus in contemporary musical and ethical terms, viewing it as suitable for adults. The musical also featured Mary Magdalene as a central character, portrayed with nuance and dignity. Yvonne Elliman's performance became one of the show's most popular songs. Mary sings about her confusion over her feelings for Jesus. Is it love? Is it devotion? Is it something else entirely? The song is tender and uncertain. It humanizes both Mary and Jesus, and it became a top 40 hit in its own right, proving that even a love song from a biblical character could connect with pop audiences when delivered with emotional honesty. Jesus Christ Superstar wasn't mocking faith, it was wrestling with it. Tim Rice's lyrics asked genuine theological questions. What if Judas had legitimate doubts about Jesus' mission? What if Jesus experienced fear and uncertainty before the crucifixion? That certainly rings true from the Garden of Gethsemane. What if the story of salvation was also a story of human struggle? The title song, Superstar, is sung by Judas from beyond the grave, questioning Jesus directly. Jesus Christ Superstar, do you think you are what they say you are? It's not reverent, but it's not dismissive either. It's doubt expressed honestly. And for a generation that was questioning authority, questioning institutions, questioning everything, that honesty resonated. The album became a massive commercial success. It topped charts worldwide, sold millions of copies, and spawned a Broadway production in 1971 and a film in 1973. The Broadway show ran for over 700 performances. The film became a cult classic. And suddenly, Jesus was back in popular culture, not as a distant holy figure, but as a character in a rock opera that teenagers could relate to. One of the most powerful songs from the musical is Gethsemane, I Only Want to Say, where Jesus wrestles with his impending crucifixion. This is Jesus in agony, terrified, begging God for another way. It's raw, it's vulnerable, it's deeply human. And for many listeners, that vulnerability made the story more powerful, not less. In conclusion, this wasn't sanitized Sunday school Jesus. This was a man facing death and struggling with faith.
What about the character of Judas in the show, Mr. Mac? I've heard the portrayal was particularly controversial.
Judas is arguably the emotional center of Jesus Christ Superstar, and that alone was revolutionary. Traditionally, Judas has been portrayed as a pure villain, the betrayer, the greedy disciple who sold out Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. But Tim Rice reimagined him as a tragic figure with legitimate political concerns. In the musical, Judas worries that Jesus' growing fame will bring down Roman persecution on all Jews. He fears that the movement is getting out of control. He loves Jesus, but questions the direction the mission is taking. Carl Anderson originated the role on Broadway, and his performance made Judas sympathetic, a man caught between loyalty and conscience. The opening number, Heaven on Their Minds, is Judas's song. It's him expressing his fears directly. Listen, Jesus, I don't like what I see. All I ask is that you listen to me. It's passionate, it's conflicted, and it makes Judas three-dimensional. For audiences wrestling with moral ambiguity in the Vietnam era, Judas's struggle felt relevant and real. The 1973 film adaptation, directed by Norman Jewison, took the controversy even further by casting the musical in the Israeli desert with an actual hippie aesthetic. The apostles look like a commune. The costumes mix biblical robes with 1970s countercultural fashion. It was deliberately anachronistic, deliberately modern, and it worked. The film preserved the urgency and relevance of the material. The relevance of Jesus Christ Superstar reveals something important about the era. Religious institutions were often uncomfortable with popular culture's engagement with faith, even when that engagement was sincere. But audiences didn't care about the institutional approval. They responded to stories that felt real, even if they came wrapped in electric guitars and rock drums. Another song worth mentioning here is Norman Greenbaum's Spirit in the Sky from 1969. This is one of the most fascinating religious crossover hits of the era because Norman Greenbaum wasn't Christian. He was Jewish, but he wrote a gospel rock song about preparing to die and go to heaven, complete with the line, "Gotta have a friend in Jesus," repeated throughout. The guitar riff is iconic, fuzzy, distorted, immediately recognizable. The song reached number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1970 and has been covered dozens of times since. What's remarkable is that the song was written by someone outside the Christian tradition, but became a staple of Christian rock radio for decades. In conclusion, it proves that religious themes in popular music didn't require personal conversion. They required respect for the power of the message and the traditions it came from.
Mr. Mac, were there other artists, a superior youth, who were bringing biblical stories into rock and pop contexts?
The early 1970s saw several artists experimenting with biblical narratives in contemporary settings. One fascinating example is Rick Wakeman's The Six Wives of Henry VIII from 1973, which wasn't explicitly religious, but dealt with faith, power, and morality through historical storytelling. But more directly, there was Ocean's Put a Hand in the Hand from 1971. The Canadian rock band took a gospel rock approach to singing about Jesus and Galilee with lyrics that referenced the man from Galilee and the man who calmed the sea. The song had a driving rock beat, hand claps, and an infectious sing-along chorus. It reached number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100, proving again that audiences were receptive to religious content delivered with musical energy and conviction. Jethro Tull's 1971 album, Aqualung, is often celebrated as a landmark in progressive rock, but it also holds a significant place as a piece of religious music reflecting the spiritual and social tensions of its era. While not religious music in the traditional sense of worship or liturgy, Aqualung serves as a critical commentary on religious hypocrisy, faith, and the societal role of organized religion during the early 1970s. Aqualung stands as a powerful, thought-provoking work that engages deeply with religious themes, making it an essential part of the religious musical landscape of its time. Ian Anderson, Jethro Tull's frontman and primary songwriter, used Aqualung to explore the contradictions inherent in religious life and society's treatment of the marginalized. The album's title track introduces us to the character Aqualung, a destitute homeless man, and throughout his story, Anderson critiques the failure of religious institutions to live up to their own ideals of compassion and charity. The album's lyrics delve into themes of judgment, hypocrisy, faith, and alienation from religion. Songs like My God confront the self-righteousness and hypocrisy found within certain religious communities. Anderson's lyrics critique those who use religion as a tool for exclusion rather than inclusion. Musically, Aqualung blends folk, rock, and classical elements to create a soundscape that mirrors its complex thematic concerns. The use of acoustic instruments along electric guitars and flute creates moments of introspection and urgency, enhancing the emotional impact of the religious critique embedded in the lyrics. The album's production also supports its message. The stark contrast between soft, contemplative passages and intense rock segments symbolize the conflict between genuine faith and institutionalized religion. In conclusion, the early 1970s saw religious narratives fully integrated into rock spectacle, proving that even the most sacred stories could be reimagined for modern audiences, and that controversy often signaled cultural relevance rather than irrelevance.
Mr. Mick, we talk a lot about rock bands and folk singers engaging with religious themes, but we cannot ignore the fact that some of the biggest pop stars of this era come directly out of gospel traditions. How did gospel shape soul music?
That's essential to understanding this entire story, because soul music doesn't just borrow from gospel, it is gospel secularized. The vocal techniques, the emotional intensity, the call and response structures, the testifying, all of that comes straight from the church. And some of the greatest voices in popular music history started out singing in church choirs before they ever touched a pop stage. Let's start with Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul. Aretha grew up in Detroit as a daughter of Reverend C.I. Franklin, one of the most prominent Baptist ministers in America. She sang in his church from childhood. Her vocal style, those melismatic runs, that emotional depth, that sense of bearing witness was forged in the gospel tradition. When she recorded Respect in 1967, she brought all of that church power into a pop context. The song was originally written and recorded by Otis Redding, but Aretha transformed it. She turned it into an anthem for anyone demanding dignity. And the way she sings it, that's church. The backup singers responding to her lead vocal, that's call and response straight out of Sunday morning services. The piano, gospel. The conviction in her voice, that's someone who learned to sing by testifying. Respect hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100 and became one of the defining songs of the civil rights era. It was secular in its lyrics, but sacred in its delivery. That blend is what made soul music so powerful. It carried the emotional and spiritual weight of gospel into songs about love, heartbreak, and social justice. Aretha also recorded explicitly religious music throughout her career. Her 1972 album, Amazing Grace, recorded live at New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in Los Angeles, is one of the best-selling gospel albums of all time. This wasn't a crossover attempt. This was Aretha going home. The album featured Reverend James Cleveland and the Southern California Community Choir, and it was pure gospel. No pop production, no concessions to mainstream radio, just faith sung with power. And it sold over 2 million copies, proving that it was a massive audience for authentic gospel music, even in the secular marketplace. The recording sessions for Amazing Grace were emotional and electric. Aretha's father was there. Mick Jagger showed up to watch. The church was packed with people who understood they were witnessing history. And when Aretha sang Amazing Grace itself, grown men wept. This wasn't performance, this was worship. And the album proved that the sacred didn't need to be secularized to reach people. Sometimes the most powerful statement was just to let the gospel be gospel. Now let's talk about Ray Charles, because his story is even more impactful in many ways. In 1954, Ray Charles recorded I Got a Woman, and it was revolutionary and scandalous. Ray took the melody and structure of a gospel song called It Must Be Jesus and rewrote the lyrics to be about romantic love instead of divine love. He kept the church piano, the testifying vocal style, the ecstatic energy, but redirected it all towards a woman instead of God. Some people called it genius, others called it blasphemy. But what Ray Charles understood was that the emotional intensity of gospel music, the joy, the longing, the sense of being overwhelmed by something greater than yourself, could be applied to human love as well as divine love. He secularized the sacred, and in doing so, he created soul music as we know it. The same approach defined his 1959 hit, What I'd Say. The song took call and response, gospel piano, and ecstatic vocalizations and turned them into a party. It was controversial. Many radio stations initially refused to play it because it sounded too sexual. Now, that controversy reveals the tension at the heart of soul music. These were sacred techniques applied to secular subjects. The line between Saturday night and Sunday morning was collapsing. Ray Charles faced criticism from some religious communities who felt he was misusing sacred music, but he never apologized. In conclusion, he understood that the emotional truth of gospel music wasn't confined to church. It was a language for expressing all forms of human experience.
A human experience in the dimensional, there are other soul artists who walk the same line between sacred and secular.
Sam Cooke is another essential part of this story. Before Sam Cooke became a soul superstar, he was the lead singer of the Soul Stirrers, one of the premier gospel groups in the 1950s. His voice was smooth, sophisticated, and absolutely devastating in a gospel context. Considered Touch the Hem of His Garment by the Soul Stirrers to verify. When you hear Cooke sing gospel, you understand immediately why he became a star. That voice could carry both tenderness and power. It could whisper and soar. And when he left gospel for secular music in 1957, it caused a scandal in the church community. Many felt he was turning his back on God for commercial success. But Cooke never abandoned the gospel vocabulary. His 1964 song, A Change Is Gonna Come, is essentially a secular spiritual, a song of hope and perseverance in the face of suffering. Cooke wrote it after hearing Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind and feeling challenged to write something equally meaningful about his experience. The lyrics are rooted in gospel imagery, being born by the river, hard times that won't stop coming, the promise of change that's coming. It sounds like a hymn about the civil rights movement, and in many ways, it was. Cooke tragically died just weeks after the song was released, shot under controversial circumstances in December 1964. A Change Is Gonna Come became his eulogy and an anthem. That's the power of a gospel-trained voices. They could transform secular music into something transcendent. Then there's Al Green, who represents another fascinating chapter in the gospel-soul relationship. Green was a soul superstar in the early 1970s with hits like Let's Stay Together and Tired of Being Alone. His voice was pure silk, his songs were sensual, and his success was enormous. But in 1973, after a personal tragedy, Green experienced a religious conversion. He became an ordained pastor and eventually returned almost exclusively to gospel music. His 1975 album, Al Green Explores Your Mind, marked the beginning of his transition, blending soul and gospel in ways that honored both traditions. Green's journey illustrates something important. For many artists, there was never a true separation between sacred and secular music. They were drawing from the same well of emotion, the same vocal traditions, the same sense of transcendence. The only difference was the subject being addressed. And the influence went both ways. By the late 1960s, gospel music itself was being influenced by soul and R&B. Artists like the Staple Singers blurred the line between the two genres. I'll Take You There from 1972 is ostensibly about heaven, about a place of peace and rest. But it sounds like a funk song. The bass line grooves. The rhythm is irresistible. Mavis Staples sings with all the power of a gospel preacher, but the production is pure early 70s soul. The song hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100, proving once again that sacred and secular could coexist and that audience doesn't need to choose between them. The Staples Singers' earlier work with Stax Records showed this evolution clearly. Songs like Respect Yourself and I'll Take You There carried spiritual messages but sounded like hits coming out of Memphis because they were. The family band, led by patriarch Pop Staples, understood that you could speak to the soul while making bodies move. In conclusion, gospel music didn't just influence soul. It provided the foundation, the vocabulary, and the spiritual intensity that made soul music one of the most powerful genres in popular music history, creating a pipeline from church to chart that transformed American culture.
Well said, Mr. Mack. We also a movement of young Christians creating their own music outside the mainstream. What was happening there?
That's the Jesus Movement, and it's one of the most overlooked cultural phenomenon of the early 1970s. This was a countercultural Christian revival, hippies for Jesus, essentially. Young people who had been part of the 1960s countercultural but were searching for something more than drugs and protest. They found it in a renewed, emotionally expressive form of Christianity that embraced contemporary music, casual worship, and communal living. The Jesus Movement started in California in the late 1960s and spread across the United States throughout the early 1970s. It was marked by beach baptisms, coffee house ministries, and most importantly for our purposes, the birth of contemporary Christian music as a distinct genre. One of the most important early figures was Larry Norman, often called the father of Christian rock. His 1969 album, Upon This Rock, is considered the first true Christian rock album. Norman's song, I Wish We'd All Been Ready, is about the rapture, the Christian belief that believers will be taken up to heaven before the end times. But it's set to a folk rock melody that could have sat comfortably on any late 60s radio playlist. Norman wasn't trying to hide his faith, but he also wasn't using the musical language of the traditional hymns. He was speaking to his generation in their own musical vocabulary. Norman famously recorded, Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music? The question became the rallying cry for Christian rock. If secular musicians could use electric guitars, drum kits, and rock structures, why couldn't Christians? The Jesus Movement answered that question with a resounding yes. Larry Norman's influence extended beyond just one song. His album, Only Visiting This Planet from 1972, tackled social issues like poverty, war, and environmental destruction from a Christian perspective, proving that faith-based music didn't have to avoid real work or real-world concerns. The Great American Novel was a protest song that called out American hypocrisy, racial injustice, materialism, political corruption, all while maintaining that Jesus offered the real revolution. Norman showed that Christian rock could be prophetic, not just devotional. Another key song from this era is Day by Day from the musical Godspell, which opened off-Broadway in 1971. Godspell was a gentler, more whimsical counterpart to Jesus Christ Superstar. While Superstar was a rock opera, Godspell was folk pop. The musical retold the parables of Jesus through song and sketch comedy, and Day by Day became its breakout hit. The song is a simple prayer. Day by day, dear Lord, three things I pray, to see thee more clearly, love thee more dearly, follow thee more nearly, day by day. It's sincere without being heavy-handed. The melody is catchy, almost childlike, and it became a pop hit, reaching number 13 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1972. It was also played on adult contemporary radio, in churches, at summer camps, everywhere. In conclusion, Day by Day proved that religious content could be delivered with joy and simplicity and still connect with mainstream audiences.
So, Mr. Mick, so we covered how religious themes entered mainstream pop, rock, and soul. By the early 1970s, how did the broader music industry react to this emerging Christian music scene?
With confusion at first, the major labels didn't know what to do with overtly Christian rock. It didn't fit in their existing categories. Too religious for pop radio, too contemporary for gospel departments. It reminds me of the niche that my best friend, Michael Raya, fills. That is exactly his sound. But independent Christian labels started emerging to fill the gap. Maranatha Music, founded in 1971, became one of the first labels dedicated to contemporary Christian music. They released albums from Jesus Movement bands like Love Song and Children of the Day, groups that sounded like Crosby, Stills, and Nash, but sang about salvation and discipleship. Love Songs, Little Country Church, is typical of this approach. Love Songs, acoustic, harmony-driven folk rock, was indistinguishable from mainstream California soft rock, except for the lyrics. Songs like Little Country Church celebrated simple faith with musical sophistication. These weren't amateur church bands. These were skilled musicians who happened to be singing about Jesus. They played at Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa, California, one of the epicenters of the Jesus movement, where Pastor Chuck Smith welcomed long hair musicians and created a space for contemporary Christian music to develop. The Jesus movement also gave rise to festivals and communal gatherings where Christian rock bands could perform. Expo 72, held in Dallas in June 1972, drew over 80,000 young people and was called the Christian Woodstock by the press. Artists like Love Song, Children of the Day, and Barry McGuire performed. It was a signal that Christian youth culture was creating its own music industry, separate from but influenced by mainstream rock. Barry McGuire deserves special mention here. He had been a folk rock star in the mid-1960s with the protest anthem Eve of Destruction. But by the early 1970s, he had become a born-again Christian and was writing gospel rock songs that retained his prophetic edge. The new sound was captured with Cosmic Cowboy. McGuire's conversion showed that the Jesus movement could attract established artists, not just young hippies. His presence at Expo 72 led credibility to the emerging Christian rock scene and showed that faith and artistic integrity weren't mutually exclusive. The movement laid the groundwork for what would become the contemporary Christian music industry in the 1980s and beyond. Artists like Amy Grant, Michael W. Smith, and Dutauk all owe a debt to the pioneers of the Jesus movement who insisted that faith and contemporary music could coexist. But even as this separate Christian music industry was forming, mainstream artists continued to engage with religious themes. Chris Christopherson's Why Me from 1973 is a perfect example. Christopherson wrote the song after a religious experience at a church service. It's a country gospel song asking God, "Why me, Lord? What have I ever done to deserve even one of the pleasures I've known?" It's humble, it's grateful, and it became a number one hit on the country charts. Christopherson was a mainstream country and film star, but he wasn't afraid to write openly about faith and redemption. Why Me showed that sincerity and vulnerability about religious experience still had commercial appeal, even as the culture was becoming increasingly secular. The song resonated because it didn't preach, it questioned. Christopherson approached faith with humility, admitting unworthiness while expressing gratitude. That humility made the song accessible to believers and skeptics alike. It was devotional music for real people with real doubts. In conclusion, the early 1970s saw the birth of a distinctly Christian music subculture that would grow into its own industry, even as that separation occurred. The mainstream continued to be shaped by artists willing to engage openly with questions of faith, doubt, and a search for meaning.
Mr. Mick, as we wind up, what is the legacy of Sacred Town?
A song of story of religious music crossing into popular culture from the 1950s to the 1970s is ultimately a song about hunger, spiritual hunger that couldn't be satisfied by the institutions alone. It needed melody, rhythm, and voices that spoke in the language of the moment. From Harry Belafonte's warm retelling of the Nativity to Led Zeppelin's mystical explorations, from Mahalia Jackson's uncompromising gospel to Jesus Christ Superstar's rock opera provocations, these decades proved that the sacred and the popular were never as separate as either religious authorities or secular critics wanted to believe. These songs didn't succeed because they watered down their messages. They succeeded because they delivered those messages with conviction, artistry, and respect for the audience's intelligence. They understood that people were searching for meaning, for comfort, for transcendence, and that music could provide a map for that search, even if it didn't provide all the answers. Perhaps most importantly, these songs proved that faith could be questioned, explored, celebrated, and even commercialized without losing its power. The sacred survived the journey to the charts, and in many ways, it thrived there, reaching millions who might never have encountered it otherwise. When heaven hit the charts, it didn't cheapen the divine. In conclusion, it reminds us that the search for something greater than ourselves has always been and will always be a fundamentally human story, and that story deserves a soundtrack.
Indeed, Mr. Mega, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. How heaven hit the charts? Well, part two dives deeper into electrifying moment when faith did not just whisper from the pews. It rolled through speakers, arenas, and streaming platforms worldwide. So, Mr. Mick, would you like do plug in something.
I appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, Grow the Business. Connect with me on LinkedIn. G. Mick, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD. Listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast. Pick up a couple of volumes I have on Amazon. On Track, Ian Hunter and Burning America. And if you're a fan of music, join True Fans.
Yes, indeed, people. Let's connect with Mr. Mick, the Doctor Digital, plus our podcast, Music 101, Sex 101, Love Letters, and Mental Health 101, wherever you listen your podcast. So, Mr. Mick, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Until next time, Deus Vult.
Morikan, people. See you soon.